Okay, let's come on in and have a seat. So excited to see everybody. Thank you, Randall, for pulling doors too back there. That helps tremendously. All right, so I got a bunch of stuff to dive into today because we're still on our marriage discussion. If you'll remember, last week we talked about the theological view of marriage. This week we want to start talking about the skills of marriage. And I'm going to go ahead and say that a good bit of this material is my gleanings from Dr. John Cox, who is a therapist down in Jackson, Mississippi. He came and did a marriage conference for us, for our church, about two years ago. He actually did another thing for RUF years before that. So I've been listening to John for a while and have tried to sort of milk some of the best stuff from that. And that is what's going on. So I was talking to a friend of mine who had a couple friend of theirs who had gone to a party, and they had gotten to the party in a way which I'm sure many of you have, which is a little bit miffed at each other. And at one point, someone did something or said something that just sort of really grated them. And so in order not to make a scene, they decided to leave the living room of this person's house and go back into a spare bedroom and have their fight out, right? And so they really start going right out of the gate. He says something super ugly to her, and she responds with something super biting, until all of a sudden, 30 seconds into just some horrible things that they said to each other, the wife looks over at a baby monitor, the other monitor of which is in the living room. And she said, about 5 seconds later, there's this gentle knock on the door. We can hear everything that you're saying in the other room, right? In other words, this is what she said. She says, even when there hadn't been a baby monitor broadcasting our tension, marriage has been very humbling for my wife and me. It's often made us face our ugly sides and still does sometimes. On the outside, you're this decent person who's easy to get along with. You'd never tell off a coworker or post an insult on someone's Facebook page. You're likable, respectful, and kind, maybe even admirable. But when the doors close at home, someone else emerges, the real you. But what if people got to listen to that person on the other end of the baby monitor? You'd probably offer the same feeble excuse you tell yourself. I'm not really like that. I'm just reacting to the other person. Whatever. If the real you, the best you, is going to emerge in your marriage, it's going to require dealing with yourself first. So true. So true. And a major sort of dose of reality for those of us that ask this question about how to get through our marriage. Well, the response that our church has given to those difficulties has been the doctrine of total depravity. Total depravity comes along and says this: you have to realize that there's something at work inside of you that affects every part of you, whether it's your thinking, whether it's your emotions, whether it's the choices you make, and that is what is at the root of our marriage problems in an ultimate sense. But here's the problem. Because those problems exist internally, we are unable to be the best people to stand outside of ourselves and give us feedback. I heard someone say one time, you can't be your own barber. You ever thought about that? Nobody can cut their own hair. You can't be your own marriage's best helper. Sin, if it's anything, is actually blindness. And that blindness has to be attuned to by what we get in marriage. Look, take another assumption. The doctrine of creation. When Adam and Eve had this wonderful marriage at first, they're there, they're naked, they're unashamed. And what we realize is that's what we really want. We want what they had in the garden where I could totally be myself, I could totally have everything that I want to have, and still have someone look at me and say they love me. John Cox's premise is that every single marriage has been longing to get back to the garden. That is the ache in your marriage. We long for it. We want to be known and still accepted, but those are two hard things to have, right? And so it brings us to problem one when it comes to our marriage. Problem one is the sense that we have an ideal, we long for it, and we're fighting with each other so we can get back to that wonderful thing. We want the ideal, but then we begin to face the ordeal. And for that reason, marriage is hard. And I realize our culture has looked at marriage and sort of held it up as an ideal and really in many ways an idol. And so what oftentimes happens in marriages is one or the other starts to hide. And yes, people learn very quickly you can hide in a marriage. which you can do that by simply not talking about your marriage struggles. That's private, my dad's generation used to say. You didn't go there. You didn't go there on those kinds of conversations. For others, you don't hide, you fight. And oftentimes you begin to wake up one day and realize, my marriage is nothing more than a perpetual contest. This is what we're doing. We're trying to save ground. We're trying to box out. Trying to keep people away from my heartaches and worries. The second problem that comes in marriage is that we look at the problems and we realize that what I'm going to do is to try to get the ideal back. I am going to make you into who I want you to be. And what we have, because I'm tired of spending all this time just longing for it, right? And so before we ever begin to sort of talk about our marriage struggles of wanting to get the good times back, we have to take judgment out of the question of marriage problems. Everyone, there should be no condescension to anyone who says that they're struggling in marriage because you married another sinner. No one ever came up after a wedding to confront me, except for the one time when I called the bride and groom sinners. And not making this up, three people at the reception came to me and was like, do you really think it's appropriate? Did I say this last week? I think I'd use this illustration. Do you really think it's appropriate to call the bride a sinner on her wedding day? And they didn't like my answer. It was like, today of all days is the day. So offended by that, right? But everybody goes through this. But here's John Cox's notion, and I think this is fascinating. The things you are doing to try to get the magic back are your marriage problems. Pause for effect. The things that you are doing to try to get the magic back in your marriage are your marriage problems. The question comes then, what is God trying to build in terms of character? How am I growing in this sense? I need to be able to manage my emotions. I need to be able to have the emotional capacity to deal with failure without plunging me into deep shame. I have to learn to deal with my emotions by what John Cox calls having my emotions and not always doing my emotions, right? When you have your emotions, you're coming along and saying, look, it sounds to me like you've had a hard day and you're taking a shot at me. Can we talk about that instead of doing what we're doing right now? That's having your emotions. Will you just shut up and leave me alone? That's doing your emotions, right? And you grow into that as you grow into emotional maturity. And so this character development has to happen from the outside in. And what we find is marriage problems often happen simply because people are missing skills. In other words, we struggle in marriage not because the other person is the problem, not because I'm trying to fix them, but simply because we lack what we need in order to make marriage happen. Why does that happen? Well, I think there's a number of reasons. Some of us may simply have had stunted growth. We grew up with bad models. Some of you grew up in homes that did not give you a very good picture of what a marriage could and should be. That happens. We also know that we can get confused in our sense of development because we have abuse in our background. That's what abuse is. Whenever you have a crossing of appropriate lines of influence in relational in marital relationships, that's where abuse happens. When all of a sudden a parent abuses their child, they're crossing boundaries and it creates powerful confusion among certain people. We also know that I've got relational wounds that I have not been attended to. In other words, there's a hurt inside me that I'm still interacting with. My dad used to always say, look, son, be very careful who you are angry with because you're probably going to turn into them. Because what happens is those angry things, especially if you've got a parent out there who is just so awful to you, that once that anger still exists, that is still coming out somewhere because pain in the life is going to come out somewhere. And our marriages are prime opportunities for that to happen. We also know that there's simple blind spots. That is, I just missed something along the way. I went along, had a certain view of life, and oh, cool, a spouse, right? And you thought that this would be the end of all your troubles. And it really started opening up things that you didn't know about yourself. So we stopped thinking about it. And not only that, when you suddenly realize that marriage is its own small business, have you wrapped your mind around this? A marriage is a small business. It takes time and a lot of effort to sort of get involved in. So here is John Cox's premise. The premise is, what are the skills that are necessary to have a happy marriage? Skill sets. What are the things that God needs us to be able to do in order to interact with each other in a life-giving way and not a soul-sucking way, as it sometimes is often created? Well, he's got four things that he mentions, and I'm going to go breezing past these at like 1,000 miles an hour, and you can go back and listen to the recording of Sunday School and really dive into them. But at least it gets us oriented about the kinds of things that hopefully we can talk about together. Skill set number one is learning to be close to someone else. Learning to know what it means to be attached to someone else, which involves fundamentally two questions that get asked. Number one, can I let you in? Am I able to let someone in? How much of my marriage is dominated by superficial, getting things done conversations? When was the last time we learned to communicate about what it feels like to be you? What does it feel like to be you? Because we need to be able to have communication, to talk about what's inside of me for real. Because the unknown enemy of marriage, and one that can make you horribly lonely, is ever realizing that even in my marriage, I'm not known. Maybe your partner has been shamed the last time they spoke to someone about what's really going on inside of them, right? But God calls this intimate sense of relationship between married couples a knowing. And it's very interesting how often the Old Testament, that word knowing is a metaphor for sexual contact. But that's not all it's talking about. It means being known. Can I let you in and see the things inside of me that I am ashamed of? Am I able to say those things? Secondly, not only can I let you in, but can I keep you in? Have I developed the ability to be known on the inside so that when you give me love, it doesn't instantaneously slip through my fingers? In other words, if you're still angry with her because she doesn't answer your text after 30 seconds of sending it, after 10 years of marriage, you might have a problem of keeping someone in. How often do I need that affirmation? Can I grow in the ability to trust that person that when they say they love me, they do? Look, you know, part love is sharing, but a second question is, can I feel loved even while you're out watching the football game with your friends without having to play the quid pro quo? Well, I'm going to go have my time with my people. So the point is can I know something is true, even if it's unseen by me at a particular moment, without getting so insecure about it that it causes me to create a fight? And what John is saying is this is a skill. It takes practice to remind yourself that just because he or she is doing something else doesn't mean that they don't love you. Am I growing in that? Yes. So God is a God of remembering. And so in closeness and attachment, we're working to see that come to fruition. Okay? Second skill, boundaries and separateness. This is a big deal. Again, two questions that are being asked here. Question number one is, in our marriage, can I be me? This is the ability to know what I want because I have grown to know who I am. Systems theorists, which I actually talk about in a few weeks here when we get to November, have a big talk about systems theory. Systems theorists will oftentimes talk about the idea of differentiation. What is that? Differentiation is where you can be okay being who you are, which I realize is difficult because over time, that's a little bit of a moving target, is it not? Because we become different people when we get married and when we have children and when we take on that new job and we our parents age, right? We change in that sense. But that differentiation means that I'm getting okay with my limitations as well. By the way, this is what's going on with your small children, a little parenting sort of thing here. Oftentimes when our children, when they're very young, they're flip-flopping almost daily between wanting to be the same as you and wanting to be very different from you. It's not always rebellion when the child looks at you and goes, no. It's not always rebellion. Sometimes it's simply them saying, I want to exercise some, where are the boundaries of me? Can I do this myself? Can I try, Daddy? I want to do it for myself. Why? Because they're thinking about being different from you. And then you go walk into places unfamiliar, and they're like, right on your leg, right? I don't want there to be any difference between you and me. No differentiation. Enmeshment, that's what I want right now. And the child flip-flops back and forth. And then they go through seasons. And by the way, teenagerhood is a massive time of differentiation. You've got someone who doesn't want for you to be the same as you. They need to be different, but they have no earthly idea who that's going to be. That's why adolescence is difficult. But being me is not selfishness. It's realizing that God has given me stewardship over what my gifts are. Did I tell my story about when College Hill burned down and the difference between me and Kurt and Brian? Did I already do that here? I've been using this so many times that I can't remember who I told it to. You're always growing, that's what I'm saying, even at 54 years old. 54 years old. I'll be 55 in a month. Don't send me any gifts on my birthday. So College Hill burns to the ground. Heartbreaking situation for everybody involved. What is the difference between Les Newsome, Brian Sorgenfrey, and Kurt Pressley when it comes to being pastors at Christ Press? I will tell you. When College Hill burned down, Kurt Pressley, when he heard the news, wept. He cried because the man's got a heart as big as Texas. That's what he does. It's who he's driven by. Secondly, Brian Sorgenfrey got up when he heard that College Hill had burned. He immediately got on his phone and texted 15 people that he knows, "Hey, I love you. I'm so sorry. How can I pray for you?" Because he's a relational connector guy. That's who he is. When I woke up and heard that College Hill burned, I spent the next 2 hours panicked over whether College Hill had their insurance papers all together. And who was going to move the chairs from the sanctuary into the thing? Are they going to be able to do that all? And I didn't feel good until I spoke to you, Kevin. You were the one. I came to you that morning. I was like, "Do they have other insurance?" He's like, "Yeah, they're fine." I was like, "Oh, great." Because that was my panic that morning. Now, here's the deal. Every minister oftentimes will pine for somebody else's gift. Does that make sense? But you got to be okay with what God has created you to be. And it's always growing. It's always morphing. In our marriages, we do that exact same thing. Now, so not only is it, can I be me, but can I let you be you? This is another skill. John Cox asked this question, why is it that doormats tend to marry other steamrollers, right? Or people who are way too much me. He says, one of the things we've got to be able to do is to learn to say no, to be taught that the world does not revolve around us, which means that I respect the boundaries that inevitably exist between persons. John says there's a subset of people who, when pushed for an answer, realize that they married somebody because they were convinced that they could change them. There's this powerful urge to nurture them, which is a good thing. But because there's an idolatry there, it turns into manipulation. That is, can I let you be you? Can I learn to fall in love with the real you, not this image of what I wish that you were be, that you would be? So if my spouse is a doormat by being overly accommodating, what we're trying to do is come alongside them and ask what they want in order to be themselves. Because remember, we're not talking about something that's inherently wrong with someone. We're talking about a lack of skills. These are abilities we're talking about. It's not about shaming people. It's about finding attempts to sort of let people grow into maturity. Number three, the third skill set is disappointment, or what we might call in a religious context, fallenness, right? So when life begins to disappoint us, what we typically respond with is protest. We protest against the pain of life, right? We blame, or maybe we pout. Maybe we get scared. Maybe we get angry. Adam and Eve, of course, are the ones who started this, right? They feel shame. And what's the first thing that they start doing? Blame. It was this woman you gave me. And Eve was like, "Well, it was the snake that tempted me." They're shifting blame. They're constantly trying to move things away in dealing with the fallenness of the world. And so the question that we have to learn in marriage is, can I forgive you? Can I face the sorrow that others are not going to be what I want them to be? Every single marriage is going to be a disappointment. And so we are cursed here. We're cursed in this world because we know it's going to be hard. And we never can take on a posture where we can assume to judge someone else without grace. What's wrong with judging is that I don't see my fallenness when I do. Am I able, have I grown in a skill to be able to absorb life's disappointment? And say, yes, I'm disappointed by that, but I'm not devastated by that because I have a center. Everybody has the same core issue of shame and judgment, feeling like no one likes me. We all feel that. What we have to work to do is learn to unshame our spouse. But what I found is the inertia is exactly the opposite. It's to have that train is rolling downhill towards making them feel worse and worse about themselves. Well, we'll see if she can get herself together on her own without me, we think, right? Well, I'll tell you what, you can go on that little journey by yourself if that's the way you're going to act. We shame. By the way, with children, this is a whole thing, right? Our children are born with shame. And the whole idea of parenting is to try to de-shame them, right? John Cox tells a story looking at our children saying, look, of course you goofed up. You're a kid. That's what kids do. Hey, I'm going to help you do better next time. But you know what? Your failure was perfectly normal. That's a person who has learned to forgive people. They've learned to not be so shocked by the fallenness around them. John Cox said this one little throwaway line. I made him do a whole seminar on it after he came back. When he said, if I can get my clients in my therapy office to learn how to be sad, I'm just mopping up after that. Learning how to be sad, because the world is disappointing. The world is difficult. The world is hard. So the question is, can I forgive you? But then also, can I forgive me? See, all these attributes have two sides, right? And this is the attribute that's for people that are constantly judging themselves. Is it possible that one of the reasons for the judgmentalism that I immediately race to with my spouse and my children and my extended family is because I still have an image of the ultimate in God that is still hanging the same sword over me? You know, that's the old mythology of the sword of Damocles, the king who ascends to the throne, but then finds above him there's this sword hanging everywhere he goes. We suddenly sort of take on this cloak of responsibility and we sort of are introduced into who God is. But because that view of God is nothing more than judgment and condescension, we got the sword hanging over us. And guess what? That's going to come out somewhere. And is it possible that I can't forgive because I myself have not grappled with that lack of forgiveness? Again, what am I doing? How have I walked through in dealing with shame? Look, shame and guilt. I like Brené Brown's definition. Guilt is the knowledge that I did something bad. Shame is, I am a bad person. See the difference? Guilt is appropriate. Guilt is a smelling salt to kind of wake us up out of our spiritual slumbers. Shame is not the place to go to, as long as the cross is what it is. You follow? But again, if you want the Bible to open this up to you, look for the theme of nakedness throughout the Bible. It's all over the place. That's the biblical idea of shame throughout, and the Bible is constantly trying to deal with it. You've heard me do my whole thing on why Jesus was crucified naked, which is a horribly embarrassing detail to bring out. Why would you mention that about Jesus? You don't need to. I mean, he's already dying, right? Why would you want to do that too? Answer: because he's bearing our shame on the cross. That's what the cross is. Jesus up there taking all the embarrassing parts of you upon himself, and his Father treating him as if he was you, and then imputing his sacrifice of death onto you. That is the only route to real forgiveness, y'all. To forgiveness in the ultimate sense. Do you have that? Is that part of your marriage? Fourthly and finally, authority and agency. This one's a little bit different, a little esoteric here. But it has to do with our ability to initiate and our ability to submit. In other words, human beings are initiators. Under God's authority, what is it that I can initiate? What has come up in my life that requires me to act? Do I take responsibility for my marriage? Do I initiate in intimacy with my spouse? Oftentimes what happens in marriage is the constancy of it creates passivity. And that's not part of God's design for us to take authority, to take dominion. And a seriously destructive part of our marriage. Because if we're passive, then my spouse really only has two options. Either do nothing and nothing happens and life doesn't move on, or initiate themselves and then grow in anger and resentment towards you for having to be the one who took care of it again. Right? Which is why we come to household tasks as sharers. I mean, that's woman's work. Or, my daddy was the one who always fixed those things. See what I'm saying? We bring in those things without any sense of initiation, right? But then second, we have to ask the question about man as a submitter. In other words, can I be powerful? Can I be powerful? That's not the right word. Can I be engaged? Can I actually move the ball forward, but also being willing to do so in a humble way, right? It's godly because I recognize that I live under authority. I want to be an initiating leader, yes, but I want to realize that when God has called, specifically in Ephesians chapter 5, for women to submit to their husbands, we rarely read the verse that precedes that where it says submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. I'm not letting this go. Because there's two ways to submit. A wife submits to her husband as to the Lord, as the church does to the Lord. A man submits to his wife by dying for her, or what the Bible calls loves his wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself up. So the submission that a man does is by setting aside his interests on behalf of his wife. See what's happening? These are two people that are submitting to one another. It's the real part of love. Submission is letting yourself lose sometimes. Oof, I ain't very good at that. It's okay to lose. Okay, I want to tell a story here in finishing this just because I think it's a fun story. Okay, so this is a guy on the right, a very younger, much version of a guy named David French. I don't know if you know David French's name. He's kind of growing in popularity as a political writer. He's a member of a PCA church up in Nashville. If you don't get David French's newsletter, you really ought to because he's really, really interesting. That is his wife. Next to him. And she wrote a story for the New York Times a couple of years ago that I thought was delightful about how when they first met, that all their friends told them they were getting married too early. Literally within like 2 or 3 months, they were married from the time they met. Everybody's like, you're a fool. This is crazy. What are you doing? This is nuts. Well, they immediately moved to New York where he's got a job he lives in Nashville now, but they were living in New York at the time where he's got a job as a litigator in New York. And she is there trying to get their tiny little apartment in Brooklyn together while he goes off and does his business. Well, she says one particular afternoon, she got a phone call and the phone rang and it was a very, very sultry voiced woman who said, yes, may I speak to David? And she says she reluctantly sort of handed the phone to her husband, and he quickly hung it up and said a wrong number. And all of a sudden, a couple hours later, another phone call, another woman. And all of a sudden, he gave it to him again, and he also said wrong number. And she said, you know, I believed him the first two times, but when it rang at 3 a.m. and then 4 a.m., and all of a sudden, these calls were getting incredibly regular day and night. She said, I got to where I was just used to these breathy voices over the phone. And she was like, what is going on? Is this really who I married? And she began to suspect that there might be a secret life. Maybe my mother and my father and all my friends were right. I married this guy. I mean, really, what do I even know about him? I don't know the first thing about him, right? I have no idea what makes this guy tick, right? So he took messages for him when he was out. Desiree, Brandy, Jill. In some cases, they were testy that he wasn't there. One more woman started crying and saying, what are you talking about? He's not there. We were just together yesterday. And she said, where? And the lady says, we were in Soho. And so she said, he thought about this and said, well, my husband works in Midtown, and maybe he had gone down there. Had I made a terrible mistake? And all of a sudden, she said, at one point, she gets on the phone and she says to this lady, are we talking about the same David, tall and blonde? And she goes, and handsome, sarcastically. And she's going to say, are you telling me that I have the wrong number? I'm looking at the note that he wrote for me right now. 212 da 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 da. And she said, yep, that's ours. It's definitely our number. And so she's like, what is going on? Well, finally, instead of a woman calling, there was a man that called. And she said, I'm sorry, he's at work. And the voice on the line said, hey, all work should go through me. And she was like, well, I wasn't sure how law firms allocate cases, but maybe David was doing it wrong. So I'll take a message for you. And the man on the other line goes, well, who are you? And he says, well, I mean, she actually says to the man, who are you? And he goes, well, I've known David for years. The real question is, who are you? Of course, she goes, he had a point. I was the new addition. Only been married here for a few weeks. And she goes, well, I'm his wife. Silence on the other end of the end of the line. And then he said, why didn't he tell me about you? And she was like, well, look, it was spontaneous before launching into this defense of getting married quickly with this enthusiasm, right? And he looks and he goes, look, I'm going to be right over, but please don't talk to anyone about this. I will help fix this. And she goes, I'm not a problem to be fixed. And he goes, are you? He goes, well, are you actually pregnant? Are you expecting a little David Lee? A kid will really hurt our comeback, by the way. And she goes, David Lee? My husband's middle name is Austin. What comeback? He goes, look, I know my client's own middle name. He goes, client? What client? He goes, I'm talking about David Lee Roth, my client. I'm not making this up. When they moved into an apartment in Brooklyn, they somehow got the same phone number of Van Halen lead man, David Lee Roth. So these women that were calling David for the comeback were actually looking for a different David. Now, why am I telling that story? I just thought it was hilarious and wanted to find an excuse to tell it to you. I do think, though, that there was a light that came on. You had Nancy living under this particular definition, right? And an assumption about all of her fears coming up. But after working through it with a different perspective and applying some simple maturity to the circumstance, she began to realize, oh, now I see what's going on. What we want to do between this week and next week we're going to talk about conflict in marriage, how to resolve conflict well, is we want to begin to say, what are the skill sets of what would make this marriage better, and how are we growing in those kinds of things together, hopefully into Christ's likeness and into a marriage that is one that actually is participating in the kingdom and not always sort of burned by it as we seem. Okay, I have time for questions. We got like 6 minutes for questions. I know that was a lot. That's like drinking from a fire hydrant right there, but you may have some clarification thoughts. So Van Halen was a rock band from the 1980s trip, okay? I just want to make sure that everybody knows who we're talking about. So I was one of those Christians in college that purchased and threw away three separate copies of Van Halen 1 because I would always go to these Christian things that told you about the evils of rock music, and the first track on Van Halen 1 is Running with the Devil, right? So this can't be a religious, so I'd throw it away. And then I'd buy it again like a couple years later and I'd throw that one away. Finally, I finally owned my digital copy of Van Halen 1, so we got over that. Found out that all music was God's music and it was a good thing, so. Thoughts or questions? Yeah, Buddy's saying we make decisions based on contempt rather than something that's truly justified. One of the things we're going to talk about in conflict resolution next week is taking a time out. It's really hard. I have learned about my own insanity that when something hits me the first time, my first reaction is usually the worst. And so we call a time out in my house. And Ginger has learned that if she starts picking, what's wrong? What's wrong? No, really, what's wrong? She's going to get like something awful. Okay, and so she knows that like we're gonna have to have about 24 hours here, hun, of no eye contact. That's the deal. For some reason, we can't make eye contact. It's really embarrassing. Y'all are being like, you're that immature. You have no idea. But why am I doing that? I'm waiting, just like Buddy is suggesting here. I'm waiting until I can have a little better perspective on myself, because I mean, none of those skill sets are at your fingertips all the time. You got to sit back and be like, okay, what did this trigger in me? Why do I always go back here? And then hopefully what we can do, talk about this next week again, is do a conflict postmortem. In other words, when the flames are not burning so high, we can actually revisit that time with calm and to be kind of like, what happened the other night? I'm really sorry. I think I acted like a jerk. And suddenly we can come to it a different way, find other ways to do it. That's true, buddy. What else? So many perfect marriages in Sunday school. That's awesome.
So it's okay to let the sun go down when you're angry.
Yeah, that's a misunderstanding. Yeah. It's funny. I've heard this from multiple people. They were like, well, Jesus was very clear that you are not allowed to go to sleep until we resolve this thing. That is not what he was talking about. Jesus is like saying, don't assume that thing's going to get better by just sitting there. Don't let the sun go down in your anger. Some of the best solutions to fights Ginger and I have had are a good night's sleep. Because I don't realize how tired I am. I really don't. That's another skill set, I think, and this part of the fallenness thing, is knowing when you are in a place of unhealth. You are. You have those places. I know you like to think, no, I'm not bothered by that. I'm fine. I know you think that, but you're not. A lot of times you're not. And there are times in which you get into certain patterns where you're worse than others. That has to be negotiated, right? I've learned that for Ginger, she's not insulting me. Ginger is just a sleepy kid. That's what she is. She's like, I just require a lot of sleep. And she does. But I would pout oftentimes when she would, drift to sleep. Anybody who's been to my house, Liza's been to my house a whole lot. She knows that one of the greatest compliments Ginger can give you is by falling to sleep while you're her guest in her home. Because it's 8:30 and that's going to happen, right? And I remember I used to pout so much, be like, she doesn't want to participate, she's not going to be here, got guests over here, what is she doing? But the funny thing was, as long as I let her have that little nap, she was actually quite refreshed after that. So that has to be negotiated. That wasn't easy early on. Still not easy. Anything else? All right. Thank you all for coming. Next week, we'll talk about conflict resolution and really kind of dive into some of those great power tips that John Cox gave that I thought were so insightful. So look forward to next week. Let me pray for us and we'll finish up with our class. Lord Jesus, we do, we know better than to think that we're going to project others that we've got a perfect marriage and perfect without any conflict or difficulties. And so we ask that you would give us grace. Give us grace maybe even if we've been married for a long time to rediscover how you want us to bring joy with each other. And maybe a sense of calm. Maybe we need to go see somebody. Who knows? Regardless, we pray that you'd bring peace so that this central part of our church community, our marriages, would have strength behind it, that our children would notice that our community would notice it, and that we'd be a light to the world about the value of knowing you. Would you do that? For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.